correct. Okay, let us begin. I don't see, we have a lot less. We've been getting 20 more people a week, but I don't know what else is going on unless they're all watching Hannity and Combs or something to hear about the latest news out of New York City, out of New York with the governor. In any event, we have to go on. Today is the sixth in the series this semester, and we hopefully will finish Rav Gorin. If not, we'll get very close to finishing Rav Gorin. I did want a few things before we start. Here is a picture. This is what Simcha mentioned last class. It's actually mine is black, not blue. Here is an example of the Tanakh that all soldiers are given. I assume that makes it the largest population, I guess you could say, of Hebrew Tanakhim in the world, since every soldier in Israel's army gets one. There's probably more of these than anything else. It says, though, on the front that it's from the Leningrad Codex. And I mentioned last class that if you look carefully, you'll see, even in Chumash itself, there's some differences. There's extra vavs. Already the Gemara says that we're not expert in Male and Chaser. That is, extra vavs or extra yuds, things of that nature. We now have a standard text, but this is only standardized with the invention of printing about 400 years ago. So a lot of these things, for example, with the codes, if you were to take this, the Leningrad Codex, which is a much more accurate Tanakh, incidentally, than the ones, a much more accurate Torah than the ones we have at our typical shuls and the art scroll and the rest, that's based on the second rabbinic Bible published by Yaakov Ibn Adonaihu in the 1500s, you will find that you have letters that are longer, and it would screw up, I guess, all the counting. But this is, as I said, this, the Chumash everyone gets. We mentioned this, the Tanakh, we mentioned this because we briefly spoke about the unified Sidur. I also, someone asked me to say another comment about Rav Chaim Ozer Grozinski and conversion, especially since we met last class. There's been more news on the conversion business. Well, first there was an agreement with the RCA, but then there was also Rabbi Lookstein, who's a member of the RCA and a member of the board that worked out this so-called agreement. Now he comes forward and saying that he's opposed to this agreement. It's sort of like, I don't know, like Hillary saying she voted for it but hoped it would fail. You know, I don't quite understand, but there's going to be lots of discussion in the future. But as to Rav Chaim Ozer, what he says is as follows, and this is a quote, regarding, remember, the issue is converts who aren't going to observe Jewish law completely. And it's a real problem today because if you want to convert children and you're not entirely religious, it's going to be an issue. He said, quote, Misha kibo alav kol mitzvot. Anyone who accepts all the mitzvot, rak shebedato lavor l'teyavon. But he intends, when he accepts the mitzvot, to violate them l'teyavon. As I said, he's going to be in a place, there isn't going to be kosher food, so he's going to eat non-kosher. He acknowledges that he's not going to be so medakdek on certain mitzvot, he's going to violate certain things. This does not take away from the acceptance of the mitzvot. Now, we know that if you convert and you say, I convert, but I'm not going to do, I won't accept this mitzvah, even rabbinic commandment, you're not to be accepted. Where Chaim Ozer is saying is that that's only if you don't accept it in theory. You don't accept the binding of nature of this mitzvah. But if you accept it and you agree that this is the commandment, but you're going to violate it, that's considered acceptable for him. However, and this is an important however, he also says that Hecha Shabarur Hadavar Shabavada Yavar Achare Keno Yisrei Torah Chul Shabbos Achilos Trefos. He says when it's obvious that the person is going to violate big commandments like Shabbos and Treif, the Anu Yodim Bederor Kavanaso Shalom Yisgar Rak Lifanim, and we know that he's only converting, he's only telling us that he accepts the commandments, he's fooling the Batei Din. Then he says it's an umdun demuchach, it's clear that it's not a valid conversion. How does this work with what he said previously in the same tshuva? The answer, I think it's obvious, is that when it's clear that the person does not accept halacha at all, you know, it's one. If someone is going to be violating Shabbos on a continuing basis, if someone is going to be eating treif, they live in a Jewish community, and they're buying treif, meat, and all these sorts of things, he never accepted Torah. The conversion is never valid. However, if he basically accepts things, but on certain occasions, as Rav Chaim Ozer says, let's hey avon. For Rav Chaim Ozer, it's clear that if you, let's say, you're living in an area and you could just as easily get kosher food and you refuse to, that's not let's hey avon. That's lahachis. You don't care. But if you do care, but at times you violate it, that's not a problem with the conversion. In the book I'm quoting from here, which is a whole book by Avi Sagi and Zvi Zohar about conversion, they quote here of Avadi Yosef, who says something a little bit different than Rav Chaim Ozer. Avadi says also that if we know they're going to convert, they're not going to observe mitzvos, we can't accept them, it's not valid. However, if we think they're going to accept it, and we convert them, and then they turn out to reject it completely, it's still a valid conversion. And we'll see today what Rav Gorin says about this. And this is a big issue among the Haredi, more modern Orthodox discussion of how to deal with converts. Okay, getting back to Rav Gorin. I mentioned last class, and this is where we ended, that it was during his time in the Army that he began to publish Torah articles on all topics, mostly in the journal Machanayim, Torah Journal of the IDF. It no longer survives. And you can see most of these articles in his various Torah books. During this time, he began to acquire a very large following. Since, remember, all religious Zionists passed through the army. And he was able to influence all these people. He did not have a position as rabbi of a city. He was not a Rosh Yeshiva. And yet he was able to influence more people than any other rabbi in the state of Israel. So that's set him up as an incredibly important person. He made a point of traveling all over the land of Israel, speaking at all the army bases, giving shiurim, speaking to the non-religious soldiers. He was constantly consulted about halachic matters. Just imagine all the thousands and thousands of people who had halachic problems in the army. He became their rabbi. Most of these people, they finish high school, they go to the army, they have no connection with a rabbi. They haven't gone to Hezdi yeshivas or anything like that. In those days, they didn't exist. He becomes the rabbi and the most important figure in their life. He had to work in practical matters also. He had to arrange the burial of dead Israeli soldiers. He had to rule on questions of missing soldiers, real Laguna questions. One of the most famous was the Dakar submarine. This was lost in 1968. It just sunk. No one knew what happened to it. It had a crew of 69, and he had to ensure that all the wives were permitted to remarry. We found, by the way, the Dakar submarine was found in 1999. But until then, it was missing, and this is a halachic problem. If a person disappears, he goes out to sea. This is a real Laguna case, but since there was radio contact that was lost, he was able to show that this is, I mean, after all, 39, I think it was 39 people, they don't just, no, 69 people, they don't just disappear. You know, they don't just leave their wives. It's not like one individual who disappears. Another story is told in the biography of him. There's a certain paratrooper base. Remember I said that he ensured that every base was going to be kosher. Well, there was a paratrooper base. Sharon was running this base, Ariel Sharon, at the beginning of the state. And they didn't want to go kosher and they didn't care about anything. Well, who's going to stop them? And Sharon said to Rav Gorin that he would only insist that the base is kosher if there was one religious soldier. And at that time, there wasn't even one religious paratrooper. Rav Gorin himself, who at that time was, he was born in 1917, so he's not much older than 30, he went through paratrooper training. On one jump, he even broke a leg. But yet, he earned his wings, as they say, and then he became the only religious paratrooper in the army, assigned to that base in his active duty, and Sharon had to make the base kosher because of him. And he ensured, following that every base in the Israeli army was kosher. Can you imagine any other Gadol B'Yisrael, any other great Torah sage, doing paratroop training? I mean, it's incredible. He would go with the various army units, do shooting practice with them. He was a very different type of personality. In the 1980s, he published a couple of volumes, four volumes actually, of it's called Meshi Mochama. And the first two, or the first three, are really focused on all the halachic issues that come up in army service. Today we have a number of such volumes, dealing with how a religious soldier is supposed to live in the army, with all the questions that come up with Shabbos, and even what you might think are the insignificant problems. You're eating bread and you have to wash. You know, how are you supposed to do that? All you have is the water in your canteen. All sorts of little problems like this. But the very first was Rav Gorin. Since then, we have many, in fact, including by Rav Nachum Rabinovich. He has a book devoted to these issues as well, but Rav Gorin was the first. He resurrected entire areas of Jewish law which had been forgotten, but were regarded as theoretical, or what we might say the Haredim regarded these as Hilchos HaMashiach. In the days of the Messiah, we'll deal with these problems. But he said, no, we have to deal with them right now. There is no Shulchan Aruch about how to fight a war, how to run a modern army. So he had to write such Shulchan Aruch, such a work. For the Haredim, that's not an issue for them. But for Rav Goren, where the religious Jews must be in the army, we have to give them guidance. And in fact, some of you, I'm sure, will be surprised by some of his conclusions. Because he has a reputation, well-deserved, as an extreme right-winger, a believer in complete land of Israel. However, if you look at the Meshiv Mochama, the first section of it, he writes very humanely about the preciousness of all lives. During the siege of Beirut in 1982, he published an article. Remember, he was chief rabbi then. He published an article in Hatzofet claiming that Israel is violating Jewish law. Why are they violating Jewish law? Not because they're trying to destroy the PLO. Of course, you have to destroy the PLO. But according to Jewish law, he says you are not allowed to surround an enemy on all four sides. The Talmud says that when Israel fights a war, they leave one side open to allow the people to escape if they choose to. If on the assumption that when they escape, they're leaving and they're not returning to fight anymore. And Rav Goren says it really doesn't matter. This is the halakha. We must give them an escape route. Remember, the Israeli Navy was in the water. They couldn't get out that way, and they were surrounded on all sides. I mean, this is shocking, I would think. After all, this is the enemy of Israel. You have a chance to destroy them, and here you're going to let them go so they can fight again. And the religious Zionist world was outraged. Rav Shaul Yisraeli wrote a refutation arguing that this only applies in Mochemes Rishus, that is an optional war, but in Mochemes Mitzvah, an obligatory war, you must do everything you can to completely destroy the enemy. And Rav Goren replied, and you can read it in one of the Torah volumes that came out a couple of years ago, they reprinted it, that absolutely not. And if you're going to say, as Rav Shaul Yisraeli said, then it makes no sense, Rav Shaul Yisraeli said, they're going to come back and fight again. What type of logic is that? Rav Goren said that in certain matters, we have to have faith in God. This is the halacha. And we don't concern ourselves with these issues. We do what halacha tells us. So incredible. And yet that was Rav Goren. Always willing to come up with a position that no one had ever thought of before. Now, when I say no one had ever thought of it, no one had ever dealt with these issues. This was an issue of Hilchos Milchama, the laws of war. I mean, the Rambam speaks a bit about this, but he's unclear whether it's Mochemes Mitzvah, Mochemes Rishus, and it wasn't practical for the Rambam. Here, it's very easy in theory to give a halacha like this, but in practice, it's very different. That was Rav Goren. He also ruled. There were some cases where, I mean, now you have many non-Jews in the Israeli army, Russians, and they're killed sometimes, and they think they're Jewish. They regard themselves as Jewish. The father's Jewish. And you had cases where the Chevra Kedisha, the local cemetery people, refused to bury them in a cemetery, a Jewish cemetery. After all, we know that non-Jews are not buried in Jewish cemeteries. Rav Goren paskened, and then enforced it, that all of these soldiers must be buried in IDF Jewish IDF cemeteries. He doesn't have control over the cemetery in, let's say, a place like Petah Tikva, even if he was chief rabbi, but he made these decisions for the army, which listened. And, I could be wrong about that. He might have had control over all the cemeteries, but he also reaffirmed this when he was chief rabbi, that non-Jewish soldiers who are killed in the war are buried together next to Jewish soldiers. They died together. They are buried together. And you could read his response, and again, in the volume of his, I think it's in the book Mishnat HaMedina, which was published a couple of years ago. He explains the logic, the halachic logic, why in these cases we're proud to bury non-Jews together with Jews. What makes him significant, also, if you read his writings, and unique, unlike any other halachic authority, is that he doesn't just use rabbinic sources. He uses historical sources as well. He uses writings of the Apocrypha. Those are the works that are not included in Tanakh, like the Book of Judith, Ben Sira, things of that. What's the point? Because the Talmud was written at a period when the Jews were no longer in power. They no longer had any independent control. They were living under the authority first of the Romans and then of the Babylonians. So he says we need to look back to writings, both Tanakh and other writings from the later biblical period, that are written at a time when Jews are independent, or at least semi-independent, like under the Hasmonean dynasty, where there was a semi-independent rulership. And you can then bring proofs from those sources, because we need to see how Jews lived, Torah Jews lived, at an era when they had power. The Talmud no longer represents an era where Jews had power and Jews were making these sorts of decisions. And since we're creating a new halacha for Jews who have power, we have to look to these sources. But have you ever heard of a posek citing works from the Apocrypha? Citing these? It's impossible. They never even heard of these writings. Aryeh Edrei, a scholar at Tel Aviv University, has an article, a very scholarly article, I can send a PDF for anyone who wants it, about Rav Gorin and the military ethic of the Israel Defense Forces. And he has a long discussion of what I mentioned before about the siege of Beirut, but he also discusses many other issues. And as he puts it, Rav Gorin, quote, sought to reconnect the biblical attitude towards power with the rabbinic attitude and thus shape a corpus that would be relevant to modern times. Again, Jews are intended to have power. That's what the Torah wants. The Torah wants Jews to have an independent state. The problem is that for 2,000 years, Jews didn't have an independent state. So as Rav Gorin points out, Jews need to once again learn how to live as a free people in charge of their own destiny. That means police force. That means army. That means all the things that Jews never had to worry about. And it's true. Rav Gorin acknowledges that if you look at Chazal, if you look in the Talmud, the rabbis put the stress on what we'd say spiritual gevurah, spiritual heroism. And this continues, by the way, in the Haredi world. The Haredi world opposes Warsaw Ghetto commemorations, revolt commemorations. They've written about a Haredi spokesman that they don't get into the whole idea of the Warsaw Ghetto because that's not what Jews celebrate. Jews don't look to physical heroism. You've had Haredi spokesmen who've argued that it was against Jewish law, the Warsaw Ghetto Revolt, because it was like a suicide mission. Rav Weinberg was very opposed to this, and he wrote how the Warsaw Ghetto Revolt was the one shining example in World War II of Jews joining together to fight the enemy. But the Haredim have always had a problem with power. They always had a problem of an independent life, of ruling their own destiny. Rav Gorin acknowledges that Chazal only speak really of spiritual heroism. However, he says that the reason we see this in Chazal is only because of the historical circumstances that Chazal were living in. They were living in an era in which they didn't have control. And Rav Gorin can point to the Rambam in his letter on astrology, who says that it's a terrible sin that Jews stopped learning the art of war, stopped learning about self-defense. He can point to the Ramban about how it's a mitzvah to take the land. That means take it by force even, if necessary. He can point to all sorts of sources. So this doesn't mean that spiritual heroism is not important, but the lopsided view of spiritual heroism, that's all Chazal cared about for Rav Gorin, that's because they were living in eras when it was unimaginable that Jews would be in control once again. Spiritual heroism, of course, is not dead. You saw in Israel last week, the person who killed the terrorist, and I can send everyone, if you're interested, a link of the man who shot the terrorist. He's a student, he's about 40 years old, but he's a yeshiva bachur, avrech at Merkaz Rav Yeshiva, and he came and he shot the students, shot the terrorists. There's some confusion whether he shot the first shots or the second. His name is Yitzhak Dadon. For those who don't know, Yitzhak Dadon, in addition to writing a number of svarim, he wrote two volumes of this work, Atchaltahi. It's all about seeing the return to Israel as a step in the Messianic era and how important it is. He has a nice chapter in here on Rabbi Weinberg. He calls me Shlita, so I thought that's interesting. This is Yitzhak Dadon, an example of a Torah scholar who's also able to wield a rifle and kill one of the enemies of the Jewish people before more people were injured. And that's exactly what Rav Gorin is speaking about when he mentions the need to bring back this ethic of power. I mean, you have people like Daniel Boyarin out in California who's written how that's the worst thing that ever happened to the Jews, that Jews have power. And he thinks that it's been disastrous, and Jews are intended in this era, I guess, this pre-Messianic era, of not having power. And I think we can all agree that there have been problems to Jews having power. It's led to certain issues. But this idea that Jews are destined to be ruled by others and not have power, which is the Neturei Karto Sofmar idea for Rav Gorin, that's akin to heresy. Now, in 1948, Rav Gorin was very well respected by the yeshiva world. In fact, in the 48 war, on one Shabbos, he was able to round up numerous yeshiva bachrim so they could dig trenches around the city to protect the city. I mean, he had influence in the yeshiva world. In this book, the biography of Rav Gorin, Rav Shlomo Gorin, Torah sage in general, you have pictures in there of him with Rav Jolti, the chief rabbi of Jerusalem, later to become his major adversary, with Rav Huttner, with Rav Aaron Cutler, I mean, certainly a very well-known Haredi figure. He was still respected by the Haredim, who saw that he was making a big Kiddush Hashem. After all, he was the one making the army kosher, making sure it ran according to Halacha. They realized that no other figure could do this. He was able to speak to the non-religious, speak to the secular Zionists, and they realized he was making a big Kiddush Hashem, and the ideological and halachic agreements would only come later. So in 1948, although he was a Zionist, he still had very good relations with the yeshiva world. And during these periods, during these years, he wrote many books. I discussed a few of them. Let me repeat again. Following his early work on the Rambam that I mentioned last class, he wrote a commentary on Tractate Berachot, the Jerusalem Talmud, though. As with Rav Kook, Rav Gorin had a special love for the Jerusalem Talmud. And they believed that the Jerusalem Talmud was going to assume much more importance. In fact, maybe even override the Babylonian Talmud in the new created state, even the pre-Messianic state. One of his arguments, in fact, in favor of a welcoming attitude to converts, we'll see this in a minute, his view of conversion, I just have to mention, because it's interesting, the view of conversion, which we've seen in Rav Uziel and Rav Unterman and Rav Shlomo Gorin, they were the chief rabbis, this has now been officially rejected by the Israeli chief rabbinates. I think that's quite significant that the chief rabbinate is now saying, they're not saying that conversions carried out by these rabbis are now invalid. What they are saying, though, is that the approach of these other chief rabbis is not going to be accepted. And it's not just l'chachila it won't be accepted. Even b'diavad, they will no longer accept that approach. So I think that's significant. But Rav Gorin points out that the Babylonian Talmud has certain negative comments about converts. One of them is converts are very difficult for the Jews. And Tosfos there explains, precisely because converts are very makpid on mitzvos, usually. They make regular Jews look bad. But there's other negative comments, and there's other ways of reading that. Rav Gorin points out that you don't find anything in the Jerusalem Talmud against converts. Again, you know, against converts, that show a negative attitude or a less than enthusiastic attitude towards welcoming converts. And he sees this as a sign that the sages of Israel were much more open to converts, presumably because of the holiness of the land. That it's a different experience converting in the land of Israel. When you convert people outside the land of Israel, you have to be much more careful, much more suspicious. But in the land of Israel, we have a much more opening attitude, and we'll see where Rav Gorin went with that. Incidentally, let me just say that Rav Gorin acted himself on this principle about conversion in the land of Israel in one of his most controversial rulings. And again, with Rav Gorin, you get psakim that you don't get with any other halachic authority, and we'll see in a minute where he comes to these ideas that you might think are crazy. In fact, the one I'm going to say now, I mean, it does sound crazy. Rav Gorin would convert people, but he would make an agreement in the conversion. It would be a Tanai that the person could not leave the state of Israel. It's a conditional conversion. If you leave the state of Israel, the conversion is no longer valid. Now, who ever heard of such a thing? I mean, it is absurd that once you're converted, you're Jewish. Who ever heard of a notion that you can convert someone, but they're only a Jew in Israel, and if they leave Israel, because the whole idea of the conversion was, this goes back to his notion that we can accept people who we're not so sure about, and we have to insist that they're going to give their kids a Jewish education. So the whole conversion depends on this. So if you leave the land of Israel, it's no longer a valid conversion because you broke with it. So as for Rav Gorin's perspective, conversion, it's not just a one-time event. And actually, you can look in the Rambam's words. You can find sort of a hint of something similar in the Rambam. The Rambam speaks about watching converts after they convert, but this was unheard of. And he was subjected to withering attack. But he didn't back down from this. He thought that this is within the authority of the rabbis. They don't have to do this, but the rabbanim have the authority to make a tanai, like anything else the rabbis can do. And they can make a conversion, that the conversion is dependent on the fact. And this woman that he converted, who then broke, there was one woman he converted who then went to England and wanted to send her kids to a Jewish school, and he declared that it's an invalid conversion, and she sued in the British Basin to get her conversion accepted. It was a whole scandal there. And Rav Gorin believes that rabbis have the authority to do something, and presumably you can make any tonight. You can make a conversion at Jeff Stan Toronto, according to him. But he doesn't speak about that. He does speak about Israel, though. Now, this ruling only became really publicly known in the 1980s, although in his article on this, he says that this was a standard thing he would do. It only became well known because it was only later when this woman left Israel and she showed her conversion document in London, and it says explicitly valid only in the state of Israel. So that created an issue. And Rav Gorin actually responded in English on the pages of the Jewish Chronicle explaining his logic. But even before then, everyone knew that Rav Gorin was different. But the extent of his unique halachic vision was unknown. He didn't create waves. He was doing all sorts of interesting things, as we'll see. But he didn't create waves because he was in the army. And this is not a place, for example, this is not a place for Haredim. Not only do Haredim not serve in the army, they have no involvement in it. They don't have any stake in it. They don't have any issues in it. Their people are not there as chaplains. They don't really care about what's going on in the army. And it wasn't an issue for them. And as I said, they knew that at least he's better there than anywhere else, and no one else could do the job that he's doing. So they tolerated him. And truth be told, he was a walking Kiddush Hashem. He traveled around the world giving shiurim all over the world. There's never been a chief army chaplain like that. Does anyone know the name of the current IDF chaplain? I know the name because I've seen him in the paper, but does anyone else? I mean, Rav Gorin would go everywhere. He saw himself as a representative of the Jewish state. Everywhere he went in his army uniform and his cap. He went to Yeshiva University on many occasions. The Rav let him give shiur in his class. And he was a walking Kiddush Hashem. The young people all over the world looked up to him as literally a walking King David, Torah scholar, worrier. This was post-Holocaust. He was, for religious Jews, the symbol of Israel reborn, of the Jewish people reborn, the Jewish people, the exact opposite of the image of what Jews did in the Holocaust. Here is a Torah scholar traveling the world showing that Jews are going to fight Melchomas Hashem. And by the early 1960s, I think it's fair to say that among the young people in the religious Zionist world, he is the most influential and admired rabbi in the world. And he was also a character, very full of personality. I was in the room with him a few times, and I even spoke to him once. I mean, he was a jokester and a very raconteur, a lively speaker. I mean, he was a very, very powerful personality. Everything changes, though. Okay, someone gets to ask some questions here. I didn't hear the beep. There's no beep for these questions, so let me see. No, he wasn't systematic in his usage, and Rav Kook is not systematic in his usage of the Yerushalmi either. Rav Kook, though, speaks about some of the positive qualities of the Yerushalmi over the Bavli. The Bavli is written in Bavel. It doesn't have the Torah of Eretz Yisrael. Rav Gorin, I'm going to give you an example soon how he uses the Yerushalmi over the Bavli, but it's not systematic. I don't think anyone in pre-Messianic times can say we're going to reject the Bavli for the Yerushalmi because all the poskim are based on the Yerushalmi. But you can use the Yerushalmi in certain cases, and you can even overrule the Bavli when you think it's important, but these are ad hoc, case-by-case basis, and I'll show you a good example in a few minutes of where he overrules the Bavli in favor of the Yerushalmi. Yeah, so Simcha says if you can have Get Al Tanai and Kiddushin Al Tanai, the only problem is the rabbis don't accept Kiddushin Al Tanai, really, although in theory you can, and you can certainly have Get Al Tanai. So you're right, but who ever heard of such a thing? That you can be Jewish in one place, not the other. I'm not saying that halakhically you can't make the case. He makes the case. But it's original. Most poskim are afraid to say something that has never before been said in 2,000 years of discussions of halakha after the close of the Talmud. Rav Gorin was not afraid to say things that no one has ever said. I'll give you some more examples soon. And part of the reason he wasn't afraid is because he made the point that we are living in an era to really see how Jews lived. The way we live now, we have to go back 2,000 years when Jews were living in the land of Israel. And they didn't have the same issue of Geirus al Tanai. So today we need to really focus on what Jews were like years ago. We don't throw the Rambam out. We don't throw the Shulchan Aruch out. But we use them in conjunction with earlier sources. So, other posting just were flabbergasted at such a concept. Everything changes with Rav Gorin in 1967. This is when he breaks out of his army shell. Many other things, of course, happened in 1967, but for our purposes, the most important of which is the creation of right-wing religious Zionism, Gush Emunim, the settler movement, Merkatz HaRav. Rav Tzvi Yehuda Cook was really a very insignificant figure before 1967. Following 1967, he becomes the most important religious Zionist rabbi in the world. Much, much more important than Rav Soloveitchik. He creates a movement that is either good or bad, depending on your outlook, but a movement that changed the state of Israel in so many different ways. Gush Emunim sees Rav Gorin and Rav Tzvi Yehuda Cook as Rav Tzvi Yehuda as the leading ideologue, Hashkafa, and Rav Gorin as the halachic authority. For those who don't know, I mean, the settlement movement, the idea that God has given us this land, and it's our obligation to settle it. This is very different than religious Zionism pre-67. Read Michael Oren's book on the Six-Day War, and you see that the National Religious Party was almost a peacenik party. They were far removed from any sort of fundamentalist ideology when it came to the land of Israel. They were not hawks. They did not have an Eretz Yisrael HaShleima, a complete land of Israel position. This all changes, and today, of course, they're an appendage of right-wing Israeli politics. Things where Rav Gorin really comes into his own then. Hopefully in a future lecture, we'll deal with Rav Tzvi Yehuda, but Rav Gorin is part and parcel of the religious Zionist revolution. Remember, without 1967, there would not be Hesder Yeshiva. There wouldn't be the year in Israel. The whole idea of American Jewry, this attachment we have to Israel, the guys in Woodmere, I mentioned this in the previous series, weren't going around with their cars saying, with the Chevron bumper stickers. Of course, the people in Chevron would prefer that they were in Chevron with Woodmere bumper stickers, but that's another issue. I mean, American Orthodoxy, European Orthodoxy has changed because of 1967, and the whole Year in Israel movement comes out of the pride that American Orthodox Jews feel in Israel, and that's a result of what happened in 1967. The Orthodox Jews become the new visionaries and the new pioneers, and secular Zionism begins to go into bankruptcy in the 1970s and ideological bankruptcy, and it's orthodox Zionism. No longer are the religious Zionists looking over their shoulders. No longer are very religious Zionists, that is, the ones who are really medoktik and mitzvos, concerned about the Haredim. It used to be like in America. Think of America or Canada, where the religious Zionists, the modern Orthodox, have this relationship with Haredim. Their rabbis are involved in our lives. They speak in our shuls. All this changes in Israel. Religious Zionism becomes very halachic. The idea that you can be a religious Zionist and be just as halachic and just as much of a Torah scholar as a Haredi, that really didn't exist before 67. You have the creation of yeshivas, of halachic observance. Religious Zionism in Israel was like it was in America. It was a watered-down version of halacha. Everything changes post-67. And Rav Gorin is there. Rav Gorin was with the first troops to reach the wall. Again, he's not some chaplain staying in the back. He's with the front line troops. He reaches the wall, and this is the famous picture of him blowing the shofar at the wall. Shortly after the day that the wall was seized, within an hour. Before coming down, by the way, to the wall and blowing the shofar, he was on top. He was on the Temple Mount, and he was doing measurements. To know where the Beis HaMikdash was, things of that nature. That was permissible then. Remember, it was during an army conquest. It was permissible to be up on that mount. He was a soldier also. While he was up there, he took advantage of the permission to do all his measurements which he would publish 20 years later. He even set up a Beit Midrash, half of which was on the Temple Mount in the permitted place to be, and it was half and half on the Temple Mount, and he began giving shiurim there. This is immediately after the war is over. The government, however, forced him to stop. and threw him off the Temple Mount. I mean, Rav Gorin wanted to establish a shul. There are all sorts of things. This is the first of many confrontations he would have. While on the Temple Mount, as I said, he took the measurements, and these measurements were only published in the fourth volume of his Meshiv Machama when he was no longer chief rabbi. When he was chief rabbi, he had to go along with the official policy established by previous chief rabbis that Jews cannot go on the Temple Mount. Even though he had taken measurements showing exactly where Jews can go and where they can't. Now, we discussed in an earlier class, an earlier series, I mentioned that growing up, and I'm sure the experience is the same for all of you, we all went to Israel on tours, and there was one thing all Orthodox Jews knew. You don't go on the Temple Mount. We saw all the UJA tours and everyone else going on the Temple Mount, and all we could do, if you go in the Shuk, as the Shuk continues in the Arab section, you can actually walk up, and you can get to the verge of the Temple Mount, and you can look in. But we all knew that from Jews do not do that. I mean, it was something everyone knew. I've never gone, and I don't plan on ever going, and my parents never went till we went to Israel. However, about 5 years ago, people started going on the Temple Mount using Rav Gorin's measurements, and last year, remember, I had quoted from you a call from all these leading rabbis, Rav Dov Lior, Rav Rabinovich, Mali Adumim, and many other leading religious Zionist rabbis who called upon Jewry to ascend the Temple Mount to show that it is Jewish territory and to know where you can go and where you can't go. So now you have a split because Rav Shapiro, the Rosh Yeshiva of Merkaz, he came out immediately and opposed that and said you can't go on the Temple Mount. And although these are all his students, they said, no, in this area, we're following Rav Gorin, and they continue to go on the Temple Mount. And what can I say? I'm sure a number of you have been to Israel listening to me right now. You've been on the Temple Mount, and it's very popular now. And it's considered a very religious Zionist thing to do. It all goes back to Rav Gorin and his measurements. It was also due to Rav Gorin that Jews were permitted to daven at Maras HaMachpelah, the Cave of the Patriarchs in Hebron. Originally, the government wanted to forbid. Well, first let me tell you when the story is, I mentioned this last class, for those who weren't here, Rav Gorin, on his jeep, rushed ahead of all the other soldiers. He reached Hebron. Everyone was indoors. He took the surrender. He opened up Maras HaMachpelah before the army even got there, him and his driver. He started davening there, and the government wanted to put things back to the status quo. The status quo was, I think it was the 16th step or something like that. Under British rule and under Ottoman rule before that, Jews were not permitted into Maras HaMachpelah. Remember, Maras HaMachpelah was a mosque. Jews were not permitted to enter. They were permitted to go up to a certain step. Rav Gorin starts things going on inside Maras HaMachpelah. The government, just like they did on the Temple Mount, they announced that Jews are not permitted to go into Maras HaMachpelah. They don't want to create problems with the Arabs. And Rav Gorin puts up a fight, creates a conflict there, and the government has to back down. So it's because of Rav Gorin that Maras HaMachpelah for so many years was open to Jews. I don't know what it is at present. I really don't know whether the Jews from Kiryat Arba, there's still Jews living in Hebron, if they still go to Maras HaMachpelah on their special days. When I was in Jerusalem last time, I saw signs up for a special gathering. You know, there are thousands of people would go on buses. Then it's safe. It used to be that Jews would go to Maras HaMachpelah every day to daven. I don't know if it's safe. I don't even know if the army lets them. I stayed in Kiryat Arba for Shabbos once. We walked from Kiryat Arba on Shabbos to Hebron. Of course, we carried guns. I mean, not me, but the people taking us. And there was a minion there. There were constantly minion in there. I don't know. I'd be curious if anyone was there can tell me. Okay, some questions. Yes, as very as Simcha says, it was a very different religious Zionism, for good and for bad. I think we can agree that the Torah study that goes on now, where the Torah study in the religious Zionist world is the equal, I would say not even equal, it's much superior to the Haredi world. Remember, the Haredi world has many more people doing it numbers-wise, but they're not producing the quality, because this is, for them, it's not people doing it because they want to, and they're not an elite. Everyone does it. So when everyone does something, it loses its significance. For the religious Zionist world, it's still very much an elitist thing, but you have thousands of people learning, and the creation of the Hezder movement and the increase in halachic standards. So that's the positive thing. The negative thing, okay, well, there's negatives also. If you're not a believer in right religious Zionism, there's a negative there. Simcha says that he doesn't think that there were more than 50-year students from the United States and Canada that year. There were some students who went to Karen Biyab, and that was it, really. You have some B'nai Akiva-type stuff. It really begins post-67. BMT, of blessed memory, my alma mater, was the first program for American students and English students, the Anglo-Saxon world. And that begins a revolution. Today, I don't know how many yeshivas there are. They open up all the time. Yeshiva, the first yeshiva devoted strictly to Americans and English-speaking students, begins with BMT, and then others get off the ground. Michala starts attracting women from America. Machon Gold, in those days, incidentally, they came after college or as a junior year. It wasn't yet a post-high school thing, but it's very different and very significant. A book came out just about 2 months ago called Flipping Out, in which three sociologists, Chaim Waxman and two others, study the phenomenon. Because here, too, you have problems. People coming back more religious than their parents. The parents think they're fanatical. There's all sorts of – this has had enormous impact on the sociology of the American Orthodox community, because it seems like 50 or 60% of all graduates of Yeshiva High School are now going to spend a year in Israel. And this, for many of them, this has lifelong, life-changing influence on their life. Let's see. When you say the proportion of halachic works, when I say proportion, I can't talk about proportion. I'm talking about in terms of works that, what I would say are quality works, significant works. The Haredim published more works. But I believe that in terms of quality, they're, let me just say what I said last semester. I don't know, I'm curious enough if you would agree. I think the quality of the work coming out of a place like Mali Adumim, you know, the works that are coming out of there are equal to that of any yeshiva. And I think if you look, man for man, authors in the religious Zionist world and what they've achieved, and I have to include in this also the Bar Ilan Institute for Higher Torah Studies, they're coming out with works. It is certainly the equivalent of anything coming out of the Haredi world, and I would argue it's much better, because I think that in today's day and age, it's not enough just to look at sugyas. You have to also look at you have to look at historical things. You take Rabinovich's commentary on the Rambam. Here is someone who's looking at all the writings of the Rambam. He's looking at Arabic stuff. He has a historical sense. To me, I think from a qualitative standpoint, that's very important. But in terms of quantity even, you have a lot of writings from the religious Zionist world. So at least it appeals to me more. You have great Torah scholars, certainly in the Haredi world. But you haven't seen an explosion of top scholarship. You've seen much more, incidentally, I think, in the Sephardic world. Much more Torah scholarship of a high quality coming out of the Sephardic Rabbanim. I don't know. I don't see it. And I try to read a lot of the Shelos and Shuvos and things like that. It doesn't. And in terms of commentaries, I don't see anything really making such marks. A lot of quantity, but not so much in terms of quality. But the religious Zionist world, and this is unique because to them, post 67, they were not writing these sorts of works before 67. So in that sense, it's very impressive. You have people like Rav Sabato, Chaim Sabato, who can be a novelist, top novelist, one of the top novelists in Israel at the same time, an outstanding Torah scholar. You have all sorts of interesting things going on. And I'll tell you that in the Haredi world, the most interesting people in the Haredi world are the ones who have relationships with these people in the religious Zionist world and are using their works and are collaborating with them. But old-time Haredi scholarship, I don't know. I don't see it as in my own opinion, as measuring up to a lot of the stuff in the religious Zionist world. But again, this is just my personal opinion. Yes, you have Chardal. Well, Chardal, which is Chardal is Haredi Datzilu Elmi, closed-minded attitudes towards secular studies, basically very similar to the Haredi world, except a Zionist perspective. This is perhaps what you might think one of the bad things, if that's your perspective, that came out of 67. The Merkaz Harav world created a notion with Rav Goren and Rav Yehuda Cook of a Chardal movement where, if you read Haaretz, there was a columnist yesterday who said that, he said for all the bad that the Haredim have done for the state, it doesn't come close to what the Chardalim have done. Now, it's a topic when we deal with Rav Yehuda Cook, we'll get into it. But the Chardalim, for all the bad you want to say about them, though I'm sure many of you do not support them, one thing you have to give them credit for, the Eretz Yisrael, the Klal Yisrael perspective. The problem is that now with the retreat, which many of them are retreating from identification with the state, it remains to be seen, really, if they're going to have anything separating them from the standard Haredi position. I don't know. It remains to be seen. Pass. Okay, but let's return to Rav Gorin. After his time on the Temple Mount, he comes down, he blows the shofar, that famous picture. But what a lot of people don't realize is they then daven mincha, and Rav Gorin is the Baal Tefila. And he reads the Nachem prayer. What does he do, though? He changes the text of it. This is the day that they liberated. This is Yom Yerushalayim in 1967. Remember what we say on Tisha B'Av. The prayer says that it's a city, it's in mourning and all that, all the terrible things that the situation of the city of Jerusalem. He changes it to, quote, the liberated city, joyful and exultant, whose children have returned to her. And after he did that, so many in the religious Zionist movement, and this was just, and Rav Chaim David HaLevi, or Moshe Malka, many others, also follow him and change the version, so that in Tisha B'Av, you no longer recite this prayer, Nachem. Rav Gorin said, and I don't know really how you can dispute this, he said, we cannot lie in our prayers. Prayers are not antiquarian. Prayers have to reflect our spirituality, our spiritual striving. We cannot be liars in our prayer. You can't ask a refuah shleima for your parent if the parent's no longer alive. You can't ask, when a woman's already pregnant, the Gemara says you can't ask for it to be a certain sex, the child, because it's already been formed. We cannot pray over a city that's desolate when now it's in Jewish hands. And certainly today, when you look at it, so you might say, well, look, we still have the Temple Mount. People responded to Rav Gorin and said, the Temple Mount is not in Jewish hands. It might be physically in our hands, you could say, but spiritually it's still desolate. Obviously, if you've been to Jerusalem recently, you know that it's not desolate spiritually either. But if you look at the prayer is talking about physical city of Jerusalem. And Rav Gorin said, we must change the version. And this is where Rav Gorin departs from not just the Haredim, obviously, but also from many in the religious Zionist world. The Rav Soloveitchik approach, I guess you could say. And not just Rav Soloveitchik, the chief rabbis were themselves very conservative on these sorts of issues. And Rav Soloveitchik is famous for this. Rav Soloveitchik believed that we cannot make any changes. Jewish life has to remain the same. And that's the prayer Chazal gave us. Okay, that's the prayer Chazal gave us. We don't change it just because it's not. We don't have the authority to make these changes. Rav Gorin said, nonsense. Prayer is supposed to relate to each one of us. So we do make it, the changes. And Rav Gorin had no problems changing texts of prayers, saying Hallel and Yom HaTzibu with a bracha, things of this nature. In fact, he thought that this is what it means to be a religious Jew. Being a religious Jew means not living out of a book. It means taking religion and life seriously. And if life has changed, if there's new phenomenon, we need to change our prayers to reflect that. That's why he did what I mentioned last time. That's why he created the Nusach Achid, the unified Siddur, for Ashkenazi and Sephardi. Because if you're living in Tunis or Berlin, obviously you're daven your Nusach. But when you're living in a state and in an army with other Jews, we need to create a new phenomenon here, a Siddur that everyone could daven from. He thought it was crazy that Jews davening in one minyan will be davening from a different Siddur, that in Kibbutz Goliot, we have to daven all together. That's Rav Gorin. There are other great poskim who have changed prayers. Rav Chaim David HaLevi changed the prayers, for example, Nachem. But other than him, I don't know any others who did. Rav Moshe Malka, I wouldn't consider him as the first rung gadol. He was a Rav of Petach Tikva. The others didn't. And many of them would say that in theory we should, but we don't have the koach, we don't have the strength, or people are afraid to do things like that. Not Rav Gorin. I don't know of any other poskim who agreed on changing the prayer like that. From the chief rabbinate of the Israel Defense Forces, in 1971, Rav Gorin becomes chief rabbi of Tel Aviv. His counterpart is Rav Ovadia Yosef. Thus begins their working relationship, which would have incredible ups and downs over the next decade. And then there is an election right after that, within a year and a half, or a year, for chief rabbi of the State of Israel, and Rav Gorin is elected chief rabbi of the State of Israel, succeeding Rav Unterman. This was an incredibly bitter election. I'll get back to it in a few minutes, but let me first tell you. Who ever heard? Look, we know that there's rabbis, and the shul tires of them, so the rabbi tires, so they let the rabbi go, and then they interview new candidates and have an election. Have you ever heard of a shul that when they have a sitting rabbi, they bring in another rabbi, and then have an election with the sitting rabbi and the rabbinic candidates? Talk about chutzpah to a sitting rabbi. the way it worked in Israel was someone was chief rabbi until they died. Cook, Rav Herzog. When Rav Unterman was in, they changed the law. And you served a term of 10 years. Actually, it was 10 years. Then they changed it to 5 years, which could be extended one. So here, Rav Unterman, who's in his 80s, and Rav Nissim, they were chief rabbis, and new elections are held. And the religious Zionist followers of Rav Unterman and Rav Nissim are outraged. How can you do this? They want the other rabbinic candidates to boycott it, to not have anything to do with it. However, Rav Avadia doesn't. He goes in, and he has backings from the more Haredi elements. And he even has a tshuva and Yabia Omer explaining why he could do that. And Rav Gorin has backings from many of the religious Zionists who see Rav Unterman as too conservative, a small c, too old, too much of the old school. The rabbis, however, uniformly back Rav Unterman. Because whoever heard of throwing out, the great Rav Unterman? Rav Unterman loses, though. We'll get back to this in a minute, because it's Rav Yashiv. He comes to prominence precisely because he backs the wrong side. We'll get back to this in a few minutes. And you can see discussion, but not too detailed, in this book. This book on Rav Gorin, Torah Sage in General. I need to point out this is not a scholarly biography. Rav Gorin is in need of a scholarly biography. This is a popular work. However, it's not hagiography of the sort that you're used to in Art Scroll. Just to give you some examples, although this book, you cannot read this book and not come out so impressed with Rav Gorin and have a real esteem for the man. But like everyone, he is a man with flaws and with faults. And this book notes them. It notes that how he seemed to have resentment to his successors in the army chief rabbinate. That is, once he went to Tel Aviv, he still wanted to control the chief rabbinate. It notes that many viewed Rav Gorin as, quote, an egocentric Eloi who put his own interests in standing before everything else. There's even a chapter in this book entitled Shortcomings, which talks about, look, not everyone has shortcomings. We could talk today about the Haredi rabbis. Some are great poskim, they're not such great lamdanim. Others are the other way. Some don't have good people skills. I mean, these are the sorts of things that the Haredim never speak about. But if you want to get a whole picture of a person, so in this book, they do speak about shortcomings, and Rav Gorin had shortcomings, like everyone. But it's refreshing in a sense that it's not a hagiography, but I guess it's sort of like a modern Orthodox hagiography, in which they want to give a whole picture, and they think that you'll still the purpose of the book is to show you how great the man is, but it has to be a realistic portrayal. I guess they realize that modern Orthodox types don't want to read a book that doesn't, it's not a realistic portrayal. Now, it's when Rav Gorin leaves the army that the controversial period in his life really begins. And it starts with probably the greatest halachic dispute in the last 40 years. And that is the Langer case. That is the greatest halachic dispute in the state of Israel. The Haredi world, let me just put it this way. There'd be no discussions today about the conversion crisis in Israel. There would be no issues today about the various other things, the Shemitah problems in Israel. You wouldn't have the issues of the Batei Din and the women, religious women don't like it. All these have to do with Rav Yashiv and the Haredi takeover. Without the Langer case 40 years ago, none of this would have happened. Rav Yashiv would have remained in the chief rabbinate. There wouldn't have been an ideology of the Haredim to move in. There wouldn't have been a figure of his stature in the Haredi world arguing. You see, Rav Yashiv, when he leaves the chief rabbinate, he doesn't want to leave it. He feels he has to leave it, and he spends the rest of his life trying to conquer it, take it back again. None of this would have happened had it not been for the Langer case. So we need to discuss it here. It's also important because the Langer case is, for good or bad, what sealed Rav Gorin's fate. He put his life on the line, figuratively speaking. He put his reputation to save two children from the taint of Mamzerus. He lost his Olam Hazeh to free two children, and one hopes and one I'm certain that he gained Olam Haba. He literally destroyed his stature, and he didn't need to do this. He did it because he felt that two children who were regarded as Mamzerim, it says in the Poskim mentioned that anyone who frees an Aguna or frees a Mamzer, it's like rebuilding the base of Migdash, he was willing to give his life up in this world in order to free these children. Now, if you want to be cynical, you say, well, it's more complicated than that. Part of him getting the chief rabbinate was built in on an agreement that he would do this. I mean, this is a cynical reading also. But I like to be Donald Kopslos and say that he was following the truth as he saw it without concern of the consequences, which were immeasurable. So let me talk about this case. As I said, the Haredi world was very upset, was getting to be upset with Rigorin in the 60s. They thought he was a showman, etc. But as long as he was in the army, and even in Tel Aviv, he's harmless. But now that he's entering Israeli life, and especially as chief rabbi, now he's the enemy. And he has power, so their anger is strong. And as I said, there was even anger at him from the religious Zionists. The upset, taking over for Rav Unterman. The Lubavitch Rebbe was very worried. He's not a religious Zionist. He was very worried about Rav Gorin. Rav Gorin had all these ideas, you know, Rav Gorin speaking about an Eretz Yisrael halacha, you know, a new halacha for the state of Israel. He was attacked as a reformer. He was talking already in the army about how we need to revamp halacha. What does that mean? When Orthodox Jews hear a rabbi speaking about revamping halacha, you know, those sorts of language, you get very nervous. And true, he hadn't done anything very, really radical in his days in the army, but people were worried that, well, just wait till he gets to the chief rabbinate, and he has control over the Batei Din. They said that the Haredi joke or the anti-Rav Gorin joke was that the first chief rabbi is a Kohen, Rav Kook. The second chief rabbi is a Levi, Rav Herzog. The third chief rabbi is a Hedyot, Rav Unterman, you know, a non-Kohen. And the fourth chief rabbi is an Apikoros. I mean, those are the sorts of things they said about him. So there's a lot of concern. Now, let me tell you about Rav Yashiv here. There's a picture in the book of Rav Gorin, Rav Yashiv, and Rav Unterman in better days when they were friends. Ayin on the Supreme Rabbinical Court. He was from an old family. They had been in Jerusalem now since the 1920s or early 30s, maybe. His grandfather was a great Makubal, Rav Shlomo Yashiv. And they were very much like the Tzitz Eliezer, the El Yashiv. They're like Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach's family. People who were in Rav Kook's camp. Rav Kook was the Masada Kedushin for Rav El Yashiv and Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach. They were very much religious Zionists of a traditional variety, of a... you know, they thought the state of Israel was a wonderful thing. However, they weren't in all the messianic type stuff, but they were involved in the state, and they were Dayanim. And this was at a time when the Haredi ruled, the Brisker Rav, the Stipler, they ruled that it's forbidden to be a Dayan. Rav Yashiv's son-in-law, incidentally, is Rav Chaim Kanevsky, the son of the Stipler, but the Haredim ruled that it's forbidden to enter Heichal Shlomo to be a Dayan. Because of that, the religious Zionists are bunny, were able to dominate. So I'm talking about people like Rav Zevin, Rav Reuven Katz of Petah Tikva, Gedol Yisrael, the Sephardic Rabbanim, but not the Haredi world. Here Rav Gorin comes on the scene. Problem number one is he wants to unseat Rav Unterman. Problem number two, and the big problem, is that he has this halachic vision, which Rav Yashiv sees as very problematic. Rav Yashiv organizes all the other Dayanim, and Rav Yashiv also was allied with Rav Avadia, to unseat Rav Nissen. There was a coalition of the National Religious Party, Rav Gorin, and Rav Nissen. The National Religious Party as a party wanted Rav Gorin, not Rav Unterman. The National Religious Party succeeded in Rav Gorin. They didn't get Rav Nissen in. Rav Yashiv organized all the Dayanim against Rav Gorin. Rav Gorin's successful. Rav Yashiv feels he must resign. He can no longer function with Rav Gorin. It's after he resigns, then, where is he going to go? What's his community? You know, he's living old-fashioned life in Ne'er Sharim. He begins to get a following of the Haredim. He begins giving Shiurim, and he is built up. So by the 1980s, he is a great halachic authority. He's not a leader of the Haredi world. That's Rav Shach and the Stipler. But after their passing, he is anointed. Because remember, it's you want to have a halachic authority if you can. Rav Shach is not a halachic authority, he's a Rosh Yeshiva. Here with Rav Yashiv, you get a halachic authority, a posek. They crown him, as it were, their chief rabbi, the chief rabbi of the Lithuanian Haredi world, and he's held this position for the last 7 or 8 years, and he has more power than Rav Shach ever had, because he also has the halachic authority behind him. None of this ever would have happened had he not been, he would have lived out his remaining years as a Dayan in the Beis Din. He would have been regarded as a nobody by the Haredi world, because the Haredi world was not interested in, no matter, this shows that the Haredi world is all about politics, because he would have been the same Talmud Chacham had he never left the Beis Din. But since he didn't have the Haredi perspective, and he doesn't have the Haredi perspective in any respects. He broke with the Haredim. He announced that we have to take over the chief rabbinate of the Beis Din. That's a complete turnaround from what the Haredim argued for 40 years. However, in halachic matters, he was always very conservative, as were many others. And he was a supporter of Heter Mechira, but today he doesn't think it's necessary. And I'm sure he's moved a bit also. But it's the fact that he has to leave the chief rabbinate that really creates the Haredim we have today. I mean, it's incredible. You read the Haredi literature, and they talk about, like, it's a, of course, we have to take over the Batei Din, and we have to have standards in the Beis Din, and they act as if this is what they've always been doing, and it's just natural that they should, insist that this conversion standards are up to what they want, and the chief rabbis, and they aren't even what they want. But it was only 10 years ago that was the thing that they said you can't do, that we can have nothing to do with the chief rabbinate. So it's really been a complete turnaround. Rav Yoshev is an incredibly significant figure. I see the time has already run out. We still need a good 15, 20 minutes to deal with Rav Gorin, because I have to talk about the Langer case. This book, very rare book, explaining how it really destroyed Rav Gorin. And also his views, there are certain other halakhic issues I need to get into with Rav Gorin, talk about what happened to him a bit after he left the chief rabbinate, and really what is his significance, because let me read you a passage that Rav Yosef Klausner, he's a scholar in Israel, a Talmud Chacham, said about Rav Gorin, and I'll repeat this again next week, but just to bear us in mind. Rav Gorin represented the total hashkafah of what the Haredi camp could not accept. He wasn't just different, he was the opposite of them. We will see next week that Rav Gorin is really the last advocate of a living halacha, a dynamic halacha, the belief that halacha needs to change, needs to be dynamic. We don't have that anymore. He was unique. He lost his battle to create a dynamic halacha. But we will see this all next week, and then we're moving somewhere, which I don't know if any of you have any familiarity with, a completely different type of Judaism from Yemen. A completely different type of lifestyle, the Maimonidean approach to Judaism. Just look around, everything you see. How much of our life is based on Kabbalah and superstition and folklore and rebbes and all sorts of things. Can we really go back to medieval times and say we're going to live like the Rambam? Lumdis, Litvisha learning. We're going to talk about Rav Kafa, who believed that we can create a new style of Judaism, which is really an old style of Judaism, the way the Rambam learned, the way the Rambam Paskin, the way the Rambam lived, and I think you'll find it very, very interesting. Okay, let me get some questions here. Rabbi Kelman informing us that the 318 classes, Heter Mechira, Existence After Death, and the Siat Kapayim. The problem with that is, for those who don't recognize the issue, if you kill someone, you're not allowed to, if you're a murderer, you can't do the Siat Kapayim, but what do you do if you're in the army and it's a Mechamas Mitzvah? So that should be very interesting also.
If you like,
okay, any questions or comments? I'm not hearing you, Rabbi Kelman.
Okay.
In fact, I'm not hearing technical support. When they send in messages, I'm not hearing the beep. So if anyone has any questions here or comments.
You hear me now?
No, not hearing any technical support. We're not hearing Rabbi Kelman.
You can't hear me when I speak?
You might have to type it, Rabbi. We're not hearing you.
Is this better? Okay, I guess everybody hears me except you, Mark.
Okay, everyone can hear Rabbi Kelman, but I can't hear Rabbi Kelman.
Yeah, I was
so,
just...
I'm sorry, Rabbi. I can't hear you.
And I do.
I'm plugged in.
I was just going to add a comment on the Langer case, if any. When I was learning in yeshiva, we were told that they asked Rav Lichtenstein about the Langer case, and Rav Lichtenstein was very troubled why they drove Rav Gorin crazy, because to be mutter and mamzer, it's very, it's not so hard. You rely on any cool in the book to be mutter and mamzer. So why did they go crazy with Rav Gorin on this? So Rakefet told us he asked Rav Lichtenstein, and Rav Lichtenstein said he asked a few of whatever the Rosh Yeshivas that he knew in the Bnei Brak. truck world, whatever. And they told him, al pi halacha, that might be true, but Rav Gordon is like a truck without wheels, and if we don't stop him now, there's no telling what he would do. That comment, it's over 20 years ago, but it stuck in my mind as quite an astounding comment, assuming it's all true in transmission, but I have no reason to doubt any of that. I know, Mark, you can't hear what I said, but anyways, for anybody who's interested, I pass that along.
Well, Robert Kelman spoke a while there. I feel bad I didn't hear any of it. It looked good. Next week, we'll be sure to make sure my hearing is working before we begin. I don't understand. This has never happened before, but maybe you'll email me later and tell me the gist. Okay. Any other comments?
I guess, I mean, if anybody has comments, they should, you know, write them in. I'm sorry about that.
Okay, I'm not getting any messages here, so we'll pick up next week, like I said, with Rav Gorin, then moving into Rav Kafich. Good night, everyone. Actually, I want to stay on for a minute with tech support and you, Rabbi Kelman, maybe see what's doing with my sound, okay? Okay, good night, everyone.